all alone. My times of trouble and pain. I used to think there was no one else who felt the cold and rain. Then I woke up to humanity. We were standing hand in hand.
Good morning, good morning. How are you doing out there? This is Dr. John Neders, Doctor of Acupuncture and Oriental Medicine, and I'm coming to you live this morning from San Diego. I'm down in San Diego for the Pacific Symposium, which is just fabulous. So if you're acupuncturists out there, if you get any chance, and I know we have quite a large acupuncture audience, which is really makes me very happy. But if you get a chance to come out here to the Pacific Symposium, make it your vacation next year. The quality of the speakers is really just unsurpassed. Some fabulous people this morning. In fact, although I love being with you, I'm going to run out of here at the first opportunity and get over and listen to Jeffrey Yuen for a while, and then a whole lineup of other great speakers. So, again, coming to you live from San Diego on my cell phone. So I hope we're getting good reception out there. And you can let me know if we are by calling in and asking me a few questions. Make sure I know that I'm still on the air. So the call-in number here is 415-543-8255. That's 415-543-8255. So please give us a call. Let me know that you're getting the show this morning and ask any questions that you want to. A couple of announcements. As I said, I won't be in town, back in town until Monday. However, our office is open. Lynn Belcher will be in on Saturday and is available for drop-ins. Whether you've been to our office before, if you're a returning patient or a new patient, either one is okay, and Lynn will be there. Last time I looked, she still had room on her schedule, so she'd love to see you on Saturday. Another announcement that I want to talk about, an old friend of mine, Clint Berner. Clint and I studied martial arts together for over a decade at the same school. We were apprentices together and hadn't heard from Clint in a little while. He just sent me an email about a workshop that he has coming up, the first part of which is this weekend. So it's kind of short notice, a couple days. But on November 6th, he's going to start teaching a Dalu class. Sometimes Dalu is called four-corner stepping. So it's the beginning of really doing two-person, what you could call fighting sets, or you could call dancing sets either way, because it looks like a dance. So they'll blend some striking. You won't actually be hit, but you'll be blending with some strikes and some push hands techniques. And after many, many years of teaching myself, I find that most people have not developed, even that have studied Tai Chi for 15, 20, 25 years, have not really developed Tai Chi to the point where it's an effective art in this way. And so this is really learning how to blend with reality, with whatever's there, a bus, a car coming toward you, someone trying to punch you, someone trying to steal your purse, the things that happen every day in life. And so this is a beginning training or an advanced training, anyone can benefit from this, in how to put those movements and that blending with life together. And so on Saturday, Clint's going to be teaching sets 1 through 3, and then in December, he's going to teach sets 4 through 6. And so the emphasis is going to be on Tui Sho or outreaching hands and how to cut potential. You know, depending on how you move your body, it really has a huge effect on whether someone can even attack you. And I could tell dozens of stories about this, but once someone attacks you, it's way, way, way down the line and often too late. So you need to learn how to cut potential. So the course is going to be from 10 to 2 this Saturday at Fort Mason. And you can contact Clint by going to CBOERNER. That's C Berner, CBOERNER, at sonic.net. Okay? C B B-O-E-R-N-E-R at sonic.net. And it's very, very inexpensive. I think it's like $50 or so. So very, very, there's also an instructional DVD or access to a secure website, too, if you want to follow up on that. So anyway, if you're hanging around and want to do something fun on Saturday, that would be a great place to go. Well, on the way down here, on the plane, I was reading the Smithsonian and some really fascinating stuff. Many of you have probably seen the Nova special. It's been played on Discovery Channel. They recently did a thawing of Utsi the Iceman. Okay, so Utsi is the guy that they found fully preserved up in the Swiss, Italian, Austrian Alps up in that area. I think they finally determined that it was Italy, but it was right up near the borders. And he's been frozen, and they bring him out every once in a while and examine him, but they took him out recently and did a thaw and then an autopsy. And they came up with some really fascinating things. So if you get a chance, either check out that special or go to the check out the Smithsonian and look at Utsi the Iceman. But one of the things, there was one paragraph or a couple paragraphs right at the end of the story that really, really grabbed my attention. And that was they determined that Utsi, who was about 5,300 years old, was infected with Lyme disease. Okay, so Borrelia burgdorferi, the spirochete that causes Lyme disease, was present, a form of it at least, was present in Utsi 5,300 years ago. And that's, to me, a very interesting finding. I've been fascinated by some of the writings of Dietrich Klinghardt. Dr. Klinghardt has been on Dr. McCullough's website a couple times, and I've checked out a couple of his articles. And he's done a lot of work looking at Lyme disease. He has a very thorough treatment plan that he goes through, et cetera. But one of his commentaries, there was one of his older articles that he had a few years ago, and he alluded to a book called Lab 257, and this book was a book that proposed the likelihood that Borrelia burgdorferi was actually escaped from a man-made U.S. military biowarfare plant in Germany, and he lists a couple of other organisms. Now, so this may indicate that Dr. Klinghardt was incorrect, or as is often the case, you know, with biowarfare types of organisms, there may have been a modification done to an organism that had been around for thousands and thousands of years, but that modification may have made it much more virulent. At any rate, it's been around a long time, and it does massive, massive harm at this point in patients that have it. Again, Utsi seemed to be pretty healthy. He was found up over 10,000 feet in the Alps. So not something you'd commonly expect to find in someone infected with Lyme disease. So maybe we've had a big genetic shift in that organism that's made it a lot more dangerous. Let's go ahead and take a call. Hi, this is Dr. Nieders.
Hey, John, it's Eric. How are you?
Hi, Eric. How you doing?
Pretty good. Hey, I think there's also some kind of lab off of Connecticut, too, in Long Island. And
I forget that it's not Hog Island, I don't think, but there's a very famous one out there that you can't even get close to that island.
Yeah.
And this Lab 257, that was the name of the book, but there are a few people who've alluded to this and written about it, very interesting. There was a guy, Faust, from a university in Germany who was looking at neurological and psychiatric illnesses. And he was tracing those to spirochete infections in the 1960s. And he was very, very good researcher. He had a clinical understanding. But they said that he could actually have a patient come in, tell him the symptoms, and he would tell them what valley in Germany they lived in because of the nuance, the subtle differences in those infections. I thought that was pretty, and they said he was 100% accurate with his prediction. So he was, you know, and he was doing this primarily clinically. But Tübingen, I think, is the city where the this bio-warp era, and the fact that it existed isn't really argued. It's just what came out of there that we don't know about.
Yeah, yeah. Well, this is my question. I have a relative that's had these red spots on her forehead for a long time. They come and go, you know, precancerous stuff.
I'm wondering, does
vitamin D, I mean, it should, I've been giving her about 7,000, or, you know, about 7,000 vitamin D a day for quite a while, but it comes back, so I don't know what the, if that's what, is it something that vitamin D should help?
It should help some. It's probably not going to be enough. I probably have to do some topical things also. I'm assuming you're talking about the actinic keratosis, the red blotches, and the skin is rough.
Yeah, I guess it grows a little bit too. So yeah.
Yeah, and does she go in and get those burned off?
Yeah, well, she has some kind of a treatment. I mean, a chemical treatment or something. Every few years, it has to go in and do it.
That's something that a few people have. There are some Western things that kind of burn it off. There are people using I don't remember the name of it at the moment, but the eggplant extract, who say they've gotten very, very good results with that. Burning it off again. I think a similar process, but I think if the eggplant works and the studies looked pretty good, you know, it may be a little safer.
I would certainly do
vitamin D internally, and I would do lots of stuff externally. I'd probably use some vitamin E, you know, to massage into it as just kind of a base. And that's the case where you really do want to keep the area, you know, covered. Not allow any sunlight on it at all, because it'll just keep coming up.
Yeah, pretty sensitive.
It is pretty sensitive, and generally those are not very dangerous. But
Okay, and I heard this guy from Italy too says you could put the baking soda on there too, but I don't.
Baking soda. I like baking soda on almost all skin conditions. I think Edgar Cayce's remedy was castor oil. Some people have used apple cider vinegar, and none of those can't hurt, I wouldn't think. Yeah, exactly. That's something that will do no harm. You might as well try it. I use baking soda for a surprisingly large number of things, even including psoriasis on the hands and feet, and I've gotten very success with that. I haven't used it with the actinic keratosis, but that's not a bad idea.
Okay. I was watching C-SPAN this morning, and every once in a while they get a doctor on there about vaccines. This guy's name was Stanley Plotkin or something, but
they just
completely deny the vaccine problem. And I'm wondering if you could give me the good sources of. They throw out all the ideas about vaccines causing problems. What are the good sources that refute that?
Basically, the number one source is there's no scientific evidence supporting them. Mercola ran an article very recently looking at some German studies, and it's mind-blowing. It's mind-blowing. Let me try to remember some of the statistics. There were, there were so many. One of the things was in the United States, there really aren't any scientific studies done on this, which makes you wonder, how many randomized, double-blind, controlled studies do you see on vaccine? The answer is as far as I know, there are none. And, of course, the way that they explain that away is, well, of course, since we know vaccines are good for everybody, it would be immoral not to give everybody the vaccines. Well, that's a pretty convenient thing. Even if you didn't randomize it, you could easily get plenty of people. We're up now to a very high percentage of people that believe vaccines should not be utilized. So it's not wouldn't mm-hmm. be hard at this point to find a volunteer group of people who would go unvaccinated. In the article he was talking about, again, this was done in Germany, and he said that about almost 30% of parents who follow the vaccine schedule think it would be safer to delay the use of vaccines. That's almost a third of the population. And the only reason that they're doing the vaccine schedule is they feel basically blackmailed into using it. About 13% of parents are using an alternative vaccine schedule, and several percent are refusing vaccines at all. So, but they did this in Germany because there's a little more awareness over there. But uh-huh. just sinus problems, okay? Sinusitis was ear infections were 22 times higher in kids that were vaccinated. It was 11% of the kids that had received vaccines had ear infections, 0.5% of the unvaccinated kids. And now, who would know that? Because all the kids in the U.S. are getting vaccines, and they're all getting ear infections, and so you're told that this is a normal part of childhood. Well, clearly, this German study shows that is not a normal part of childhood. It's clearly at 22 times has to be a causative problem, right? So, and again, you're not going to see any of this information. This German study isn't going to get out in the mainstream. It's not going to be widely talked about or published, right? And if you go to Barbara Loewy Fisher's site, and I don't remember that is, but if you just Google her in or go to the National Vaccine Information Center, National Vaccine Information Center, they will have links to a lot of these things, and they break it down by vaccine. So they'll tell you, you know, which seem to have, and again, we don't have good evidence for a lot of these, not just because it's not available, but they will break down which of these cause the most lawsuits and which seem to cause the most adverse events. And again, the diphtheria, tetanus, so there's the Tdap and the Dtap and all these always rank at the highest. You know, at one time, last time I looked, I think 3/4 of the money awarded for adverse events was for that vaccine. And things that they found in the German study, they pointed to things like multiple sclerosis, which has shown up in a few studies, rheumatoid arthritis, lupus, autism. So a lot of autoimmunity and inflammatory problems. And, of course, those just, make great sense.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you just mentioned diphtheria, tetanus. When you get a tetanus shot, that's just tetanus by itself?
Yeah, tetanus is just tetanus. But on the vaccine schedule for kids, they're getting, again, one of the problems is, although there hasn't been good, in my opinion, science done on any of the vaccines, what's even more appalling is there certainly hasn't been any research, any studies done, at least that I've seen, looking at this overwhelming assault. Kids in the U.S. are expected to get 48 doses of vaccines by the time they're 6 years old. Okay, I think it's 14 different vaccines, but 48 doses. And each one of those is designed, it's not an accident, they are designed to cause inflammation in the system. That's how they work, and that's why they add adjuvants to them to cause even more inflammation and a stronger immune response. And by the time a kid is 18, I think they've had 65 or 70 doses of these vaccines. One of the things to remember about a vaccine is they do not, absolutely do not infer the same type of immunity that a naturally acquired infection does, because the route of entry is different. When someone is exposed to measles, mumps, something of that nature, it's coming in through the respiratory tract. So the body starts to mobilize, and then it goes in generally into the intestines. And the immune system is mobilized, and then it gets systemic, and then a further aspect of the immune system is mobilized. In injections, you're bypassing that, and you're putting it directly into the body so that the immune system responds differently to it. This is, it creates a completely different thing. And there was a study that was initiated by vaccineinjury.info, okay, vaccineinjury, that's all one word, .info, and what they were trying to do is look at the difference in overall health, not whether they caught a particular disease, but the overall health of kids that had received vaccines versus the kids that were not vaccinated. And they have huge numbers of surveys that they've received. So if you're willing to, parents, this would be a great service. And who knows, maybe they'll find that vaccines are the best thing in the world. I don't know. But it would be good to gather that information, and it is not being gathered. So if you're willing to contact vaccineinjury.info and give them your information, it could be very, very helpful.
You said something about measles. Didn't we used to wait out measles and chicken pox, things like that? We just waited them out, didn't we?
Yeah, of course we did. And I talk to MDs, and they say, oh, my God, do you realize how deadly measles can be? And my response is, yes, it can be deadly. And if you look at the cases where it does become deadly, where it causes meningitis, encephalitis, you know, really severe problems in the brain, versus the number of adverse effects or of adverse events, I think you would not vaccinate. I don't know, but that's my thought looking at the numbers.
Yeah.
Now, in this vaccine injury trial, what they found is that, and again, this is not a double-blind controlled study, so, you know, it's not the gold standard, but their preliminary data is really scary. Allergies, just, you know, across-the-board allergies, 40% of the vaccinated kids reported at least one allergy, and in the unvaccinated kids, it was less than 10%. Asthma was 6% in the vaccinated, 2.5% in the unvaccinated. And you can go right down the list. And I said 11% for middle ear infections versus less than 0.5. And I have seen so much evidence of children coming in within a day to a week after receiving injections and having middle ear infections that, to me, it's just hard to argue it. So the one of the really scary things was in the autism numbers, and it's off the scale. So I'm not even going to quote those until they get the final numbers in here, but the autism numbers in vaccinated kids versus unvaccinated was literally off the charts. So please, if you're willing to, parents, check out Vaccine Injury and help them gather some information.
Okay. Well, I appreciate it, John.
Anything else? Uh-huh.
Nope, that's it, I guess. Thank you.
Okay, take care.
Yep. See you.
All right, bye-bye. You know, one of the things, natural exposure, as I said, because it's coming into the body, gives both cell-mediated immunity and humoral immunity. And that's actually very, very important distinction. So I'm not going to go into all the distinction of that, but if you have a minute, start looking that up. Look up the, you know, cell-mediated and humoral immunity, and notice what you see there. Okay, let's go ahead and take another call. Hi, this is Dr. Neeters. Hello? Kwong, is there anybody there?
There we are.
Hi there. Hi. Hi, Kent. How are you doing?
Kent. Hello?
Good morning.
Yes. By the way, the name of that eggplant-based treatment?
Yeah.
Is Curaderm.
Curaderm. Thank you.
C-U-R-A. They sometimes refer to it as BEC5.
BEC5 is what I had seen.
Okay. The doctor who came up with it is Dr. Cham, C-H-A-M.
Now, they've done clinical studies in Britain of that, haven't they?
That I don't know. I've been told that it is an accepted standard treatment in some countries, not this one yet, but in some countries.
Right. Okay, cool. Thank you.
Somewhere online, I think you can get a free e-book on the so-called eggplant cure. So it's by Dr. Cham's group.
Okay, excellent. Thank you very much, Ken.
You're
welcome.
Appreciate it. My question is, why do we hear so much about peanut allergies these days, to the point where kids can't bring peanuts to school or something?
Because they are off the charts. Off the charts. I don't know how it was, you're a little bit younger than I am, but when I was a kid, from kindergarten through high school, right, that's a long time, I never heard of any kid in any of my classes having a significant, in fact, any food allergy, and never heard about peanut allergies. It was never brought up, ever. That's
right.
How rare they were.
That's right. I had never heard of it. I knew of, like, one kid who had a chocolate allergy, and that was about it.
Right. And now schools are just, you know, they're going, you know, with good reason, they're just having to monitor this very, very carefully. And a lot of schools will not allow any children to bring any peanut products into the school. And I think my guess, again, I can't prove this certainly, my guess is we have a couple things going on. One, you know, from the hygiene theory, showing that kids that are kept too sanitary, you know, which is typical in our culture today, develop a tremendously higher number of allergies because their immune systems seem not to learn to react to allergies properly. You know, there's a direct correlation. The more times kids spend playing in the dirt, the more times kids play with barnyard animals and other animals, the lower their asthma and allergy rates. And so there seems to be something that doesn't develop properly in the immune system in kids that are kept in very sanitary conditions. The other thing, I think, you know, looking at this German study and the vaccine info study, I think it sits right there. There is this massive dysregulation. I think there is so much inflammation being created in the system that and one of the reasons it's a little hard to track is because it can show up in so many different ways. It can show up as a dozen different autoimmune diseases, or it could show up as peanut allergies. So that's my suspicion, is that we have inoculated our bodies with substances that upregulate the immune system to such a point that we start having overreactions to a variety of problems. Now, again, I certainly can't prove that, but I don't see any other reason. Because, you know, one thought is that historically people that had a peanut allergy or some severe allergy probably died very young, so right. They didn't reproduce. And so, therefore, their genetic line would not be carried forward. Now, you know, because we have the ability to treat anaphylactic shock and to understand what the problems are, it would certainly be easier for those types of allergies to be passed on genetically. Okay, so that's a piece. However, I don't believe the problem has been around long enough for us to see that genetic shift yet.
Right.
Because it wasn't there in my generation, and I'm not that old.
Right. You know? I think genetics, that kind of selection takes a couple of centuries to get going.
Typically, at least, yeah.
And also maybe genetically modified food, putting proteins into foods that really don't belong there.
Well, that's certainly another factor. You know, we know that animals given genetically modified food just flat out die. You know?
Okay.
So there's got to be, you know, the reason we don't die from genetically modified foods so quickly is we're eating a variety of foods. But if you take an animal that eats only corn, basically, or you put it on a corn-based diet, and you give it genetically modified corn, they die in a matter of weeks to months. You know, and we look back at the what seemed to be rather cruel now, but, you know, they certainly served their point. The studies done by Francis Pottinger, I believe, in Pasadena, when he was looking at the effect on cats, and he would put them on diets of, you know, whole milk and then different types of modification of milk with pasteurization, et cetera, and then also on meat and looking at what happens when you cook the meat, et cetera. And the animals put on pasteurized, homogenized milk died very quickly versus the ones that did survive, they're going downstream genetically. There were huge genetic defects. So whenever we try to, and that's what we're doing constantly, to modify our food supply, our bodies are not yet designed to deal with those. So, yeah, putting genetically modified food into our food stream and into our bodies, it cannot be a good thing. And it's just a matter of how bad is it. And I think it's really bad.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Well,
yeah.
Okay, well, thank you, sir.
Hey, you're welcome. Thanks a lot. Take care.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Yeah, it's tough down here looking out, seeing the ocean, little warm ocean breeze. Wish you could all be down here. But anyway, enjoy it vicariously through me. Hi, let's go ahead and take another call. Hi, this is Dr. Nieders. How can I help you?
Hi, good morning, John.
Hi there.
Hi, John. Oh, I'm glad you're enjoying that beautiful breeze.
Yeah, it's wonderful.
Oh, wonderful show. Well, Joe, I'm a personal witness to Curaderm. I go into this health food store, and the gentleman there had terrible, skin cancer, and it was on the chest and the arms and the face, and he's going to have surgery. And I recommended the Curaderm, and he got it. It's a little expensive, $120 for a small size, but it took all of it away. The doctors were amazed.
Wow, that's amazing. Yeah. And I have to tell you, I've heard that from a couple people, and I don't talk about it a lot, but I've had a couple of patients come in and tell me either their personal story or something like you're telling me right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was severe, so he's very, very thrilled about it. But, John, John, thank you for your wonderful show, helping us just in a magnificent way. It's changing our lives, so I can't thank you enough. And I'm sure all the people that listen to you just want to give you golden big hugs.
Well, I don't know. I figure somebody want to throw tomatoes at me, but that's okay.
Well, I kind of doubt it. But anyway, John, this gentleman, I heard about this young man. He's mid-30s to maybe a little bit 38 or 9, not sure. But what happened when he was a young, 15 years of age, the doctors gave him Accutane for his acne, and they gave him double doses for four or five years, John. Now the kidneys, are not doing well at all. They wanted to do a transplant, then it's dialysis, then the kidneys get better, and then he's supposed to go back, but he can't afford to go back to get another test. But the thing is, the blood pressure sometimes is, at one time, it was 235 over 125. And this blood pressure issue, and the situation is that, and he tries to watch his diet and exercise, but what happened recently, a major concern to his mother, is that when he go to sleep at night, he only sleeps 4 hours. He's taken melatonin and everything, can't sleep any longer. But he said his eyelashes were feeling like big wings, and he could hear his hair, his beard growing. I mean, what kind of sensitivity? I wonder, is that the brain?
Well, it sounds like a pretty horrific sensitivity. I mean, that's very, very sad.
I know, John.
And Accutane, I don't know if there are, caution people. Again, it's not my job to either prescribe or not prescribe or talk people, tell people not to use drugs. But Accutane has been on my list for a long time, and it was so commonly used. One of the reasons I started to get very concerned about Accutane is that almost all of my female bowel problems patients, ulcerative colitis patients in particular, inflammatory bowel disease, almost all of them had used Accutane, and I thought it was just a little bit too much of a coincidence. And so I started looking, and I saw some early studies back in, I think the American Journal of Gastroenterology had stuff in 2006, and there was some stuff before that, looking at, and this had been thought about a while before, but by 2006 it was listed as a, quote, highly probable, end quote, cause of many cases of inflammatory bowel disease. So, nasty drug. I actually hadn't heard it much for kidney disorders, but it's certainly not any great leap to think that it might be, given the problems with inflammatory bowel disease.
John, what, is some idea of something to bring the blood pressure down or help the kidneys?
If it's a kidney disorder, it becomes dramatically more difficult. Kidney diseases are some of the most difficult, in my experience, to treat, because once those microtubules, these very, very small and very, very delicate parts of the kidney become damaged, they may be irreparable. There's a little debate on that, mm-hmm. and I have seen patients make somewhat of a recovery from that, but that's something that is one of the scariest things for me. And part of the problem is it's very hard for us to treat that herbally, which is our number one treatment for that, because the kidneys are going to have to do clearance there. Now, one of the things with any kidney problem, and I'm not speaking yet to the blood pressure, is that because the kidneys are involved in clearing these toxins from the system, you have to be as careful as possible not to add more toxins. I've had several patients come in with different kidney disorders, Berger's disease, minimal change disorder in a couple of young women, and when I tested them, and I tested them expecting to find it, they had secretory IgA allergies to wheat. And what happens is that those very large immune complexes that get formed when the protein is there, and it's an antigen, we call it, and then we get an antibody response, it forms this very large structure. And that has to be broken down in the system. And if the kidneys, if there are certain types of kidney problems, it's those molecules actually back up in the kidneys and start causing more significant kidney problems. So finding out if there are any food sensitivities, IgA or IgG sensitivities, would be really critical in my mind for that. Now, that's probably not going to get down the blood pressure. That'll probably have to be done with drugs. Once the kidneys are damaged to that point, it's hard to do anything else.
Right.
Hello?
Okay, yeah. John, I'm here. Is there any teas or anything that would be good for blood pressure and kidney?
Oh, there are tons of them. But again, that's one that it has to be done very, very specifically and particularly, and that I wouldn't give out information over the phone. Because
okay.
This is one of those very few conditions, and there are very few of them, where the herbal treatments could make it worse because, again, of how the kidney has to respond to that. And so that's one that he needs to get in and see an herbal expert if he's going to do herbs for that.
Right. And I don't know, do you think stem cell repair or just...
Well, stem cell repair is pretty much magic. So from what I'm seeing, the reports coming in and from people that I talk to that are in that field, actually, I talked to a guy at the Taoist gathering who does create equipment to monitor those things. And he says the things that they're now doing with stem cells, he said, would just, they're mind-boggling. So, whether or not the stem cell stuff will be developed quickly enough to help him and whether it would help that condition, I don't know.
Right.
But we're seeing huge, huge breakthroughs in stem cell research.
I think the City of Hope does it. John, do you know any place that does? I think they do adult stem cell at the City of Hope. I'm not sure.
I do not. I don't know who's doing that right now. I know for a while, it was very hard to get anybody to do it, and I had patients that were going to China and other countries to get it.
Right.
But there are now quite a few studies going on.
Okay.
Of course, the way they're done in the U.S. is being randomized is someone could get into a study and not actually get the stem cells.
Okay.
Right? So that's a problem in getting into a study. But, yeah, I would just get online and start checking it out. That's not something I've looked into.
Okay, John, this clay, you can bathe in certain clays, I don't know.
Yeah, there are quite a few different clays, yeah.
Yeah, that might be helpful.
Well, that would be exceedingly helpful. Because the kidneys their job is to pull waste out of the urine, right? So this fluid goes through this amazing system of filtration. The kidneys are to allow the toxins to go out through the urine, and they salvage and save the proteins and the other things that we need to live. And when those microtubules and the glomerular apparatus is damaged, they can't do that effectively. So anything that helps the body to detoxify would certainly be good for the kidneys. You want to make sure the liver is very healthy, and you can do as much for that. Breathing, far infrared sauna might be good, depending on his condition, because the far infrared sauna will both, or a heating pad like I have, the Biomat, because it does two things. One, it causes a lot of perspiration, and that type of perspiration that is done under far infrared is very different than the type of perspiration that you get, say, from a hot rock sauna. When they analyze that, there's on a hot rock sauna, the perspiration is almost 100% water, with the far infrared, where it's penetrating deeper, you get actually a significant amount of other waste products and fatty molecules that are actually coming out through the perspiration. So that's one piece. So you're going to detoxify. But number two, while someone is in that sauna or lying on a biomat, they get a tremendous increase in blood flow. And a lot of that is from relaxation of the arteries. Dr. Oz even wrote something fairly recently looking at that as a way to lower blood pressure. So I would think far infrared in either of those forms is something you really want to look into. Baking soda baths, clay baths, anything that's going to draw those toxins across the skin would be a great idea.
Okay, John. That's extremely helpful. Thank you
so much,
John.
Also, lymphatic massage, gentle lymphatic massage also, just to get things moving.
Okay, John. Thanks a million.
You're welcome.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye, Linda.
Bye.
The kid, real amazing system. Amazing system. Well, let's see. Let's go ahead and... before I take another call, you know, I had several calls over a couple-week period about PSA tests. And an article I got recently, and there's something called the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force. And they're the people that recommend against different types of healthcare screenings for people to see if they're more or less beneficial. And they have come out and they've said that they've given the PSA test the lowest grade that they give. They gave it a grade of a D, D as in dog, which in medicine, means the same thing it does when you're in high school. It means very close to complete failure. And so they're recommending against the PSA test. And again, they're saying that it causes far too many false positives. In the 17 years since the test became the screening test, we've seen about 2 million American men treated for prostate cancer, but the death rate has not changed at all. So, you know, treating all these extra people isn't lowering the death rate, and there's some good reasons for that. But bottom line, the PSA test leads a lot of men to have biopsies. Last week we talked about the rate of infection and death after biopsies, which is very, very high, around 7% for infections. I think it was 6.9. And so now the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force is saying, stop, enough. If that wasn't enough, the doctor that invented the PSA test, Dr. Richard Ablin, he said, and this is a quote, "The PSA test is a hugely expensive public health disaster, and that it is, quote, hardly more effective than a coin toss." Okay, now this is the guy that invented the test, right? Richard Ablin. "The PSA test is a hugely expensive public health disaster and hardly more effective than a coin toss." And he invented the darn thing. Okay, let's go ahead and take another call. Hi there, this is Dr. Needers. How can I help?
Good morning, this is Kate. How are you?
Hi, Kate. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. I love San Diego. I used to live down there, so enjoy.
I never really appreciated it. Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to follow up with our conversation about the methyl bromide in the spraying of walnuts and nut crops. I did some research to confirm that.
Pardon me?
I did some research to find out more about what's going on.
Could you kind of give us Kate and I were talking at the Taoist gathering with a couple of people, and Kate was talking about some of the issues with walnuts. Would you be willing to kind of talk about our conversation?
Sure. I had mentioned that I went to the farmer's market and was talking to my walnut grower, and she said that she called a commercial commercial company that shells nuts for growers. And the commercial company said that if they shelled her walnuts, they would have to spray them with methyl bromide by California law. And she didn't know that. And then in the subsequent conversation, I asked her about it again, and she said, well, there's a law that requires any commercial sheller to spray all nuts, because as soon as they're harvested, they're required to do that because they said they'll go by, they'll go bad, they get rancid in transport. And so I went online and started looking for information about methyl bromide to find out what's really going on, because I asked another small grower the other day, I says, what about your shells, your almonds, are they hand-shelled? And she didn't know, and she says, I thought methyl bromide got phased out. So I went online, and in fact, there it was phased out as of 2005, according to the Montreal Protocol International Treaty, of which the United States signed this treaty with 26 other countries agreeing to phase it out. But then I found another site where in February of this year, the United States applied for exemption to that treaty to use it for certain crops based on the fact that any substitute or not spraying is because it's not technically and economically feasible. And the exemption they filed was specifically for walnuts, dried fruits, and they listed prunes, raisins, figs, and dates produced in California. And the application for the exemption also included replanting of certain orchards, which included nut orchards, so they're allowed to spray the soil. I mean, it just went on and on and on, and what they can use it for, tomatoes and eggplant and peppers. I mean, it's just, I was outraged when I read it. I couldn't believe it. So the most informative website I found, because I had to really hunt for this information, was toxopedia.org, if people want to go and read and get some background on it.
Is that,
but that's
T-O-X-I?
Why our food's being sprayed.
Okay. Is that T-O-X-I-pedia?
Yes.
Toxopedia? Okay, great. Yeah, I mean, methyl bromide is deadly. I don't know what the specific classification is, but it's a pesticide that has killed quite a few people, and lots and lots of health problems. You know, kidney problems, neurological problems. That's pretty scary stuff.
Well, even worse than that, though, is there's a new fumigant that has been introduced to substitute for the methyl bromide. The farmers are talking about possibly using this, and it's a fumigant called methyl iodide, and the EPA is saying it is not safe for anything. And so they may start using this in 2015. It may replace methyl bromide, and it's worse. So there's a debate about it, and you can go online and read more about it. But it's a big conversation because in California, because our crops are, you know, the nut crops are a $1 billion business, and the farmers don't want to lose their crops to insects. That's the problem.
Well, and the takeaway from that to me is shell your own nuts, right? I don't think you can trust any, I mean, from what you're saying, trust any commercially shelled nuts.
No, you can't.
Yeah.
And the next tricky part is, because I went out to a bunch of my stores looking for nuts, and I just saw that Whole Foods just started having, you know, the big bins of hazelnuts and pecans and all the different kinds of nuts 2 days ago, but they're not organic. And they have said they'll probably have organic ones, you know, close to Thanksgiving, which means, you know, the organic ones are going to be harder to come by, I guess. But if you want to get around the methyl bromide, even if they're not organic, at least you're not getting that extra fresh spray, so you can shell them yourselves.
Yeah. So anyway, eating the nuts, just shell them yourselves. And again, that makes those shells are magic anyway. Like so many other things in nature, eggshells, walnut shells, they're there for a reason. They keep these fats from becoming rancid. So, Kate, thank you so much for following up on that and just scaring the heck out of me now with the methyl iodide. I mean, methyl iodide, I don't know a lot about it, but in my, you know, my research into iodide and iodine content or issues, I know it's covered under Prop 65, meaning it's known to cause cancer. So that's, you know, why would we put that in our food stream? It's kind of amazing.
Yeah, it's scary that there's so many exceptions. Yeah, my pleasure.
All righty, take care.
Okay, bye.
Well, on a lighter note, maybe, let's take another call. Dr. Neeters.
Hello.
Hi there.
Hi, how are you?
I'm
fine. This is my first time calling you. My name is Ms. Fulmore, Flora Fulmore.
Uh-huh.
And I wanted to ask you about, I've had a stroke in May.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm only 58 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been coughing since the stroke. But now it's becoming to the extreme. I cough quite a bit. It's like particles of something that's in my throat. I can't get it out. I cough to the point where I have convulsions, you know, and I'll vomit, you know. And so I was wondering if there was anything you could do for that. Also,
uh-huh.
There was a test where you go and see whether or not the fluids, the foods, because I do it when I eat, I get choked.
Mm-hmm.
See where the foods are going, or if they're going in a proper place, or they're being stored in there for, you know. Because
and what was the result of that test? Did they feel the food was going in the proper direction?
I said, well, is there any type of test that they'll do that besides an x-ray?
Well, there are, depending on what they're looking for, they can examine, there are tests to discern, to test swallowing reflexes, and there may be a problem with the swallowing reflex where things are not going down the esophagus. They may be getting over into the trachea, getting into your lungs, and that would be a very dangerous thing. So perhaps in the stroke, maybe there may have been something in the throat that was damaged neurologically, and by that I mean the nerves that feed that area from the brain may have been damaged. And that's certainly something that needs to be checked, because if you're inhaling even small particles of anything into the lungs, that can be a life-threatening condition. So definitely there are tests for that, and you should definitely get that checked out, because that's exceedingly dangerous.
Yeah.
And also, do you know if you had a blockage or a bleed? The vessels were blocked by a blood clot, or if there was bleeding?
No blood clot or anything.
Okay, so that means it was probably a bleed. So this is a really critical thing that you get fixed immediately. Those heavy coughing episodes could even cause another stroke because of the pressure that builds up
in
the head.
Yeah.
So I only have another couple minutes here, but I really want to encourage you, either you or someone that's advocating for you, this is not a minor issue. This is a very, very major issue, because you could develop pneumonia from aspirating food particles, or it could cause another stroke. And you need to get your doctor, if you have to call them every day, someone needs to take this very, very seriously. Are there any other parts of your body that have been damaged that you're not functional with, arms, legs, et cetera?
Well, the only other thing, it's just that one side of my body is larger than the other.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why.
Right.
And I'm retaining fat or something. The foods have caused my lower back to hurt.
When did the stroke occur?
May 3rd.
Where do you live? What area?
In Sacramento.
Sacramento. I would recommend getting in to see an acupuncturist up there. Having the stroke in May, there's still things that can be done, and they may be able to, again, I've done a lot of stroke work. I've been trained by a couple of Chinese stroke doctors, and their results are phenomenal. Now, I don't see a lot of stroke patients just because people don't think of coming to an acupuncturist, but actually the two stroke guys that I worked with get better results at post-stroke recovery than any other form of medicine on the planet. So So I would highly recommend that you get in and see an acupuncturist to see if this can be turned around. And the stroke doctor that is most famous for this is a fellow named Shur Jway Mean. And there was actually a movie made of him that made the rounds a little while ago. So the first name is S-H-I.
Okay.
That's actually his last name. S-H-I.
S-H-I.
J-U-E.
J-U-E.
And then M-I-N. Shur Jway Mean. So even if, and his stuff is available, and even if you find someone that wasn't trained by him, and there is a woman in Davis I know that was trained by him, because I went to school with her. And if you can get over there and you want to contact me, I'll give you her information. But even if not, the information is relative. Pardon me?
I'm sorry. I'm in the Bay Area today, but I would like to contact that person.
Okay. I want you to email me. If you go to my website, thebalancingpoint.net, there will be a site for an email. Email me, reminding me of my conversation, and I will find her information and send it to you.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Yeah, because this is, I've seen good results even years after a stroke, but the earlier the better, and this may be reversible.
Okay.
Now, but in the meantime, get to your medical doctor and don't let up until they examine you, because this could be very dangerous from two different aspects. As I said, the pneumonia or that coughing to that level could cause a second stroke.
Yeah, because I noticed that when I take my blood pressure, it goes up.
Oh, yeah, it does. One of the most common times that people will have a stroke is either while they're having a bowel movement, because they're straining, if they're straining and they're kind of holding their breath, that causes the blood pressure to go up. Or it can also happen during a coughing attack where there's so much pressure created that it can trigger it.
Okay.
All right?
All right, then.
Thank you for your call.
All right, then. Bye.
All right, y'all. I want to thank you so much for tuning in, and I want to give a little shout out to Joel Thielen, acupuncturist in Dubuque, Iowa, who suggested to one of his patients that she listen to my show, and she just sent me a fabulously wonderful letter. That was from Linda in Galena, Illinois. So thanks for listening, Joel. I'm going to head off now and go listen to Jeffrey UN. You all be happy, be healthy. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Balancing Point Radio Show with John Needers, Doctor of Acupuncture and Oriental Medicine and licensed acupuncturist. You may contact the office of John Needers at 510-814-6900 for appointments. That's 510-814-6900. Also, go to the website www.alamedaacupuncture.com. That's www.alamedaacupuncture.com. Be sure to join John Needers in the Balancing Point Thursday mornings, 8 a.m., right here on KEST AM 1450.
Whether I'm at home or at work, I just love to have fresh flowers in my environment. And while some people wait for other people to give